morning. So last time we talked about implementing our control logic for forwarding. We said, okay, we know sort of what forwarding is and that we want to do it when we don't have an up-to-date value of a register we read. How do we actually implement that? And sort of our key idea is that we can look at what values which have been computed but aren't written yet, or where they're going, and compare that to what register we read. And the way we do this as well, when we use our register file, we pass a register index. So we like think of our register file as an array, like we have an index into that array which says whether we're getting REX, RBX, and so on. And we compare those two indices just numerically to find out, is this value later on in the pipeline one that is one we want to read? And we also mentioned when we're doing that, we have to be a little careful. So for example, sometimes we have multiple options. There would be multiple versions of a value that was about to be written, and we need to choose which one to use. We want to make sure we chose the most recent one. We don't want to get one which isn't the most up-to-date one that we can get. We also talked about, well, what are our options for forwarding? So our textbook just said we're going to forward to the end of the code, and this makes sense. We're thinking of, okay, I'm going to read a register, and sometimes that's going to be wrong, so I'm going to fix it up right away. And that's a nice idea. We don't have to do that. We can forward to lots of places. And we have some restrictions, though. So something that a lot of people might want to do is they might say, oh, we can do this forwarding idea to take a value from that we've computed somewhere and use it somewhere else. So can't we like take the output of memory and send it right to the ALU? Right, just in the cases where the instruction that's in the memory stage is computing something that we need in the execute stage right now. And the answer was no. And the reason why not is because this would make our critical path longer. That in our worst case, when we were actually doing that operation where we took a value from the memory stage and then used it in the instruction that was in the execute stage, we'd end up needing to have the memory read a value and then the execute stage do addition or something. And the way we set our cycle time is that, well, we set our cycle time based on this worst case, so that's what our cycle time would always be. It would always be set up for that case. Even if we never actually ran that combination of instructions, that's how we'd have to set our cycle time. This would make our processor a lot slower, so it's not going to be acceptable. But as long as we aren't violating that restriction, we can do other forwarding, not just to the end of decode, and we learn that some cases this might be useful. Because for example, if we're loading a value in our memory stage and then storing it in the following instructions memory stage, we could use forwarding to avoid stalling in that case, even though our textbook does not. And speaking of forwarding and stalling, we learned, okay, well, sometimes forwarding doesn't work. And on our five-stage processor, we had the example of where we're taking a value from memory and trying to use it in the execute. And in this case, we're not going to give up on forwarding. Instead, we're going to stall until we can forward. So we're not going to stall all the way until the value's written back. We're just going to stall until the value's ready to be forwarded. So we're going to detect, oh, there's a value I'd like to read, but it hasn't been computed yet. We're going to wait until it's computed, and then rather than waiting for it to go to the register file, we're going to use forwarding again instead. And that's still going to be a lot better than if we were only using stalling for that case. So questions on things we covered last time? Okay, so based on quiz scores, I think I probably should go over questions 1 and 2. Let's start with quiz question 1. So quiz question 1, we had this. For question 1 and 2, we had the same piece of assembly code, and we had these different pipelines. So for question 1, we had our memory stage split into 2. So our first instruction goes for fetch, decode, execute, and then we have our 2 memory stages, memory 1, memory 2, and write back, and there's nothing special happening. Then our second instruction, well, it needs the value to compute RCX plus 8, and we're going to forward that, there's no problem. Then our third instruction, it needs the value of RAX, and also it's going to need the value of RCX, but at least the value of RAX, and that's not available until after the memory 2 stage. So we needed to delay, actually, our execute stage until after that. So I ended up with 2 cycles of stalling because I needed to make sure that the execute stage of the subtract was after the memory 2 stage of the MRMove queue, because otherwise we can't use the value that memory 2 stage computes. So questions on how I figure this out? And once I had this timeline, I just counted my cycles 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Making sure that the 1 was the same place the question said the 1 was. For question 2, we had 3 execute stages instead, and this made our first 2 instructions a little different. So here, I needed the value of RCX. It wasn't available until after the execute 3 stage, which meant that before I could use it to add 8 to it, which happens in execute 1 of the next instruction, I need to wait for it. So this meant I had 2 cycles of stalling to do that waiting. I needed to delay the execute 1 stage until afterwards. And I still had to wait till after memory to get the value of RAX, so I needed to delay the execute 1 stage of the subtract until after the value was read from memory in the MRMove queue. And that required another 3 cycles of stalling. So I ended up with 5 cycles I needed to stall in this case, even though I was using 4 of them. Just because I needed to wait until the value was ready to be forwarded, which means I needed to wait till it was actually. So questions? Yes. Okay. So our main topic for today is going to be on control hazards. So here I subtract R8 and R9, and if I get 0, I'm going to jump to OXFFFF. Otherwise, I'm going to run this add queue. And if we think of running this in our pipeline, we have a problem during cycle 2. During cycle 2, I want to set my PC to either OXFFFF or the address of the app. And to figure that out, I need to actually have the results of the subtraction, which hasn't happened yet. So this is a control hazard. We don't know what to set the PC to. And we learned earlier that a way we can resolve any hazard, maybe not the best way, is with stalling. So we can use stalling to solve this problem. So the way stalling would look is that we'd wait until SF and ZF were updated, and then we use that information to compute the next PC, and then we'd fetch the right value. So I have 2 cycles waiting for SF and ZF to be set, and then my jump instruction actually computes, the thing to fetch, and then finally I move on to actually running the correct next instruction. So, written another way, what this might look like is we can think of the jump as moving through the pipeline, but it doesn't get to actually compute what the value of the next instruction is until its execute stage, when it can use the SF and ZF registers to do that. So we need to wait until the value of ZF and SF can be sent via the flags, and we can't actually read them usefully until we get to the execute stage, because that's the latest they might be set by the previous instruction. And then once we compute what to go, we can tell the next stage, sorry, next cycle, what to fetch in the fetch stage. Now you might say, wait a moment, isn't the operation of using the condition codes fairly simple, and couldn't we maybe do that in the same cycle in a different fetch right away? I think some processors would do that. Our textbooks design, they've decided that we're going to assume it takes a full cycle to use the condition codes and turn it into the address to go to. Though indeed, we could do that in the same cycle as we fetch that. That might mean that our fetch stage is a little longer, right? Because instead of just using our stored PC value or value from elsewhere, we're now doing a bit of computation, That's probably why our textbook didn't do it, but some real processors might say that's an acceptable trade-off. Yes, even though the fetch is going to be a little longer, we'll let that happen in order to save a cycle in this case. Okay, so this is for conditional jumps, if we're implementing them with stalling. We also have return. So for return, we need to read the return address. We're going to read it from memory. That has to happen in our memory stage. And there's a good reason why we probably can't, in general, read it earlier. One reason is that other instructions might be doing things with the memory. Another reason is that, well, in the worst case, the return address is stored right before. So just like we had to worry about the condition codes being set right before we got to execute with the conditional jump, we have to worry about the memory value being set right before with return. So we're going to read the value from memory, and then our assumption is that in the next cycle, we'll actually be able to use the value. We don't want to do it. That wouldn't make sense to say we do it in the same cycle because reading from memory takes a long time. It's much more complicated than like using condition codes. So I don't think any processor would say we do that in the same cycle. So questions about our stalling solutions for conditional jump and return. Yes?
So why are we like checking for the flag in the jump case? Previously we just checked the result of the execution. Doesn't that work the same way as the flag?
Question, why are we checking the flags instead of checking the actual result? So if we think of how our processor works, we don't actually store the full result, we store the flags. So that is the information that the jump instruction is going to have to read because we don't choose to store the full last result. We could do that, but that's not a very common design because that's a lot of information to store. Also, it turns out that like figuring out if a value is zero is not free, so we'd like to have that done in advance. Other questions? Okay. So if we're doing, so we talked about implementing things with stalling. So if we were only doing stalling, we have three cycles for our data dependencies. We have three cycles for return. We have two cycles for every jump. Now, this is not the processor we've implemented so far. We're going to get better. So we have with stalling and forwarding, we have up to one extra cycle for data dependencies. So this is a big improvement. And we're going to have a further improvement we're going to talk about today, where we're going to make this an extra zero or two cycles. So sometimes we're not going to take two cycles. We'll talk about how we're going to do that today, but with just stalling, we would have that too. And with an improvement we'll call branch prediction, we're going to be able to make that zero or two cycles to further improve that. We're not going to have a solution for return. For return, we're going to actually end up implementing stalling. It turns out real processors do have a way of making return faster. We might talk about that very briefly, but we're not going to try to implement it. So before we move on to talking about how are we going to make this down to zero or two, let's look at, now that we know how we'd implement conditional jump with stalling, let's assume we're doing conditional jump with stalling and talk about what dependencies are here, what forwarding happens, what sort of what this timeline looks like. So can someone get me started? Tell me what dependencies we have. Tell me a dependency. Just anyone. Yeah. So the MR move queue to through RBX. Okay. Any other dependencies? Yeah.
The RCX in add queue and RCX equals add
queue. Okay. So the RCX between the two add queues. Okay. Any others? Yeah.
RDX.
So RDX to RDX. Okay. Any more? Yeah. Okay. Any others? There's one more thing I would consider a dependency. Yeah.
The bottom RCX and the second
one. Okay. The bottom RCX and the second one. So between here and here. Yep. That is also a dependency. Okay. There were two more I would consider a dependency. There's one more left. Yeah. Back there. Jump in the add via the flags. So the add sets the flags, that's SF and ZF, and that the jump depends on that to figure out what to do. Okay. So we have our dependencies. Now we want to figure out what happens here. So we have timeline. I should make sure I write this so I have enough room. So we have these instructions go normally. And then we have this dependency, right? So our jump is going to go through our pipeline, but it's not actually going to be able to compute the next instruction until it has the flag set. So this is going to be, this is not forwarding, this is the flags being set. I guess before I do that, I should talk about the add. We have our dependency with the add. So we need to get the result of the add forwarded to, sorry, the result of the MR move queue forwarded to the add. I should actually handle that correctly before I move on. So the result of the MR move queue, when is it available? It's going to be read from memory. So it's available at the end of the memory stage. So it's available here. So if we run our add normally, we'd like to read it here, but we can't do that yet. So we're going to have to stall to handle that, and then we're going to forward the value. So we first have a cycle of stalling to handle that dependency. Then our jump, well, we can only move it on afterwards, and we're going to have our add is going to store the values and the flag registers, and our jump is going to read those values that it stores. And we're going to use this to compute the actual address of the target of the jump. So that's going to happen at the same time as the write back stage of the add. And then we're going to keep executing normally. So as far as our dependency on RCX here, well, by the time we read RCX, it's already written. We don't have to do anything. So there's a dependency, but it's not a hazard in this case. And then we have the dependency of RDX. We're going to have to, in fact, forward that. So this is my timeline with our stalling for the conditional jumps. We had these two cycles during which we could have fetched two instructions, but we didn't because we didn't know what the jump's outcome would be. But normally we would have fetched two instructions. So questions? Yes. Question, isn't it just reading a code? Yes. So if we're following our textbook design, our assumption is that it's going to take some time to actually look at the condition codes and determine what the actual PC is. I think it wouldn't be unreasonable to assume there might be other processors, not the one our textbook describes, where we make that decision as part of the fetch stage, but that makes the fetch stage longer. Like, because I agree it's a simple operation, but it's more complicated than a MUX, right? Than a normal MUX operation.
It wouldn't happen during the decode stage?
So would it happen during the decode stage of the jump?
No, because if you're saying that you're like checking the condition codes for the jump, right?
Yes.
So would the checking condition
go? Question is, when would the checking condition go to happen for the jump? So in our textbook's design, this happens in the execute stage of the jump. So, and when it happens, we don't actually use the results until the next stage, next cycle. So another design we could have, which wouldn't be unreasonable, is that we could like check them during the execute stage of the jumps and use them immediately in fetch. But this means the fetch stage has to be longer because it has to have the extra time in it to do that check, which many real processors probably really do because it's faster, but our textbook design says we're not going to add that extra time to the fetch stage. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? So we have our timeline with our stall. So this stalling idea seems like it's pretty annoying when we have conditional jumps. And an annoying part about it is that we're basically wasting two cycles. That normally, you know, we'd fetch something here, and I'll draw this here. So normally, rather than waiting these two cycles, we'd fetch something, and we'd fetch something else. And now we're just wasting those cycles doing nothing. And a trick we have is that we can guess. So that if I have a jump instruction, and I have this jump not equal to label, I can make a guess as to what would happen, even if I don't know for sure. And there's two things I could guess that make sense. Like, there's other things I could guess, but they don't make sense. But the guesses that do make sense are that we'll run this XOR instruction next, or run the instruction at label next. So I can make guess one of those things, and if I just choose randomly, I'm likely to be right about half the time, which is sure a lot better than being right never and always fetching nothing. So our strategy is we're going to make a guess. And our textbook has chosen that the guess we're going to make is we're going to assume it always goes to the target, goes to the label, namely that it's always taken. And this is an educated guess, because it turns out if you look at real programs, typically conditional jumps are taken, or not typically, but more often than not, they're taken. And you might say, why is that the case? Well, think of loops. If you have loops, loops typically go to where the jump says when the loop is running. So more often than not, they're taken. So this is a better than 50% strategy. So what we're going to do is we're going to guess. So we're going to, in fact, run these instructions in pink, making a guess. And there's two possibilities. So one possibility is that we're right. So let's say I guessed the foo instruction here. In that case, I just run the foo instruction as if the jump was, you know, a knock. And I'd, in fact, end up doing forwarding for it. So in this case, it wants to read the add instruction here, wants to read RCX. So we'd, in fact, forward RCX to it, and we do our normal forwarding. Now let's say we're wrong. That's where it gets tricky, right? Because if we're right, we're just two cycles faster. But if we're wrong, we need to somehow undo our guess. And that seems problematic, right? We don't want to guess an instruction, have it change something, and then the program has the wrong answer. So we need some way of, if we guess that some instruction and we're wrong, we need some way of undoing its effects. And in general, that could be pretty complicated. And it turns out there are real processors which implement the strategy in cases where it is pretty complicated. But we're lucky. In our pipeline, it is not actually complicated. I'd say, why? Well, doesn't instructions do a lot of things? Like, they write registers, they write memory. Seems like a lot of bookkeeping to undo that. But the trick is that during the first two stages, instructions don't change anything other than pipeline registers, right? We're just preparing stuff. During the execute stage, if they get that far, they just change condition codes. And then we have, like, real changes. But if our instruction only makes it to fetch or decode, I'm doing it. It's just forget the values in pipeline registers on the PC. Forgetting the value in the PC, that's kind of free because we're replacing it with the new target, the place the jump's supposed to go. Otherwise, we just have to deal with the pipeline registers. Everything else is not a problem. And it turns out our instructions only make it as far as decode. Before we figure out here, right, this is all we're going to run in the case where we guess wrong, because we can stop it there. We figure out during jump's execute stage that, oh, that's when we don't need to move on. So we'll be able to stop them before they actually make any changes outside of pipeline register, so we don't have any extra work to do. If we couldn't do this, it's still possible to implement the strategy because it's a lot more complicated. Like if we let them get to execute, we like have to remember the old condition codes and like restore them, which real processors do, but that's a lot more complicated. Here, we just forget them. So what we're gonna end up with is when we speculate right, so in this case, I have my jump not if equal to add an R remove queue. We're gonna fetch those two instructions. They're going to go through our pipeline normally. We're not going to be sure of them for the first two cycles, and then we're going to figure out they're right. We're going to do nothing. It's free. We did less work in the case where we guessed right. We basically just treated the jump in this case as an unconditional jump, and we found out, we just double-checked that that was okay. It was okay, and we didn't have to do any extra work besides what we did to implement unconditional jump. And we did a lot of extra useful work because previously we had these slots in our pipeline were nothing, doing no useful work. But of course we can guess wrong. So in the case where we guess wrong, we're gonna have to somehow undo these wrong guesses. So this is gonna be known as squashing, that's the actual jargon term. So we're gonna undo them, and the way we're gonna do that in our design is we're gonna just make them not go through to the next pipeline stage. We're gonna replace them with something that represents nothing. It's not literally nothing because we have to put some numbers there, but we're gonna put like no do nothing values. And we're gonna have to have some logic to override the normal PC plus whatever to use to fetch the thing that is after the jump. So questions about sort of the timeline of this prediction idea. This is also this general idea, we call it speculation, also known as branch prediction. Branch is the name for like a conditional jump. This is branch prediction. Questions about what our time pipeline looks like in branch prediction. Okay. So let's do a little exercise. So with our branch prediction idea, since we're predicting not taking jumps still incorrectly, we're still gonna take the same amount of time for them as when we stalled. And for taking jumps, now we're taking one cycle for them, the same as like a normal instruction where we don't do anything special in our pipeline, versus we took three cycles. We had those two wasted cycles before. And everything else stays the same. For return, we're still handling that pretty poorly. So we still handle that with four cycles because there are three cycles of stalling waiting for the memory stage to happen. And our other instructions take about one cycle. I have asterisk here because we know that if we have like an M remove queue followed by an add of the value we just loaded, that's gonna take an extra cycle. We'll just assume it's roughly one cycle. And let's say we're running a kind of realistic mix of instructions here that we have a program, and 3% of its instructions are not taking conditional jumps, 5% are taking conditional jumps, 1% are returns, and 91% are other things that only have data dependencies that are basically resolved through forwarding. And my question is, how much faster is the predict processor versus the stall one, assuming we have the same second time. Who'd like some more time? So could someone tell me what's a good first step? How should I start this problem? So you want to multiply our percentages by the amount of time. So we want to do 3% times, let's say, 3 plus 5% times 1 plus 1% times 4 plus 91% times 1. And what is this computing? See, total time. So I would say this is the average time per instruction. So a way of thinking about why this is the case is, let's say we had 100 instructions total. We're thinking of the total time they take is 3 of them take 3 cycles, times 5 of them take, plus 5 of them takes 1 cycles, plus 1 of them takes 4 cycles, plus 91 of them take 1 cycle. We add that all together. We divide by the number of instructions. This is the same value we're computing here. So this is the average time per instruction. So this is equal to the average cycles per instruction on the predict version. That makes sense. So I'm just computing the average cycles it takes on the predict processor, and I can do the same for our stall processor. And since we know the cycle time we're assuming is the same, that's the numbers we want to compare. So questions on that logic? So we end up with the math I did, which hopefully isn't incorrect, that I got about 1.09 cycles per instruction with our predict processor. So a way you can think of this is that when we implemented pipelining, and originally we said, oh, we're going to finish one instruction per cycle. Turns out we can't do that. But we have these cases where we need to stall, which is going to make it take extra. So we're going to be significantly slower than that, but still a lot better when we take into account how short our cycle time is than our single cycle processor. And with stalling, I got 1.19 cycles per instruction. So I'm about 10% faster, and you could have maybe done this with sort of as an approximation without actually doing all the numbers by saying, oh, wait, we have 5% of our instructions, we're making 2 cycles faster, so that's about 10% faster. And an observation to make here is that even though the instructions which benefited from this were just 5% of our mix, we had a bigger change because, well, it was more than a cycle of change per instruction. Also, we got a pretty big benefit, even though our guesses are, you know, right only slightly more than half the time, right? But just guessing was the biggest benefit, right? That we made a prediction is where we got our benefit. It didn't really matter that our predictions were not much better than chance. That's fine. Like, obviously, it would be better if we had them right, if we somehow predicted, right, you know, not like 60% of the time like we are now, but like more like 90, but we still got a lot of benefit from just making a guess, even though it's, you know, it's only slightly better than a coin flip. Questions about our calculations here? Okay. So we've talked about our sort of what mechanically happens with our prediction. So let's go through a timeline here, and let's assume that here we're using our same strategy of predicting that the jumps will always go to foo, and this one is not taken, so this is mispredicted. So I'm asking, what does the timeline look like in this case where we have a mispredicted instruction? If it was predicted correctly, well, that would be the same as if we replace this with a knock, right? If this was predicted correctly and instruction 3 was where foo went. But we're assuming it's mispredicted, I'm asking what happens with our pipe. And also what forwarding needs to happen. Okay, who would like some more time? Well, okay, so let's get started. So first thing to say is, okay, so we're gonna run these instructions normally. And for our add instruction, our jump instruction's gonna wait till its execute stage when it knows it has the latest value for SF and ZF to actually compute things. In the meanwhile, we're gonna make a guess as to what instructions to fetch. And we're going to be wrong in this case because the jump's not taken and we're guessing it is. So we're going to fetch two instructions, so level 2B and 2C, that aren't actually the right ones. And while this is happening, we're going to finally have the values stored in our flags registers. We're going to read them during our jump, figure out what to do. And one thing we're going to figure out we need to do is that we need to undo those misprinted instructions. And that's just going to consist of making them further in the pipeline, be replaced with not. So they're going to be squashed. So we're going to have something going through the pipeline, but it's going to end up being a no operation. Just do nothing values going through a pipeline instead of whatever those two instructions were. And we have two instructions because that's exactly how long it takes us to figure out what the correct PC to fetch is. If we took a different amount of time, we'd have a different number of instructions. So once we receive the correct PC, we can finally fetch instruction 3. And instruction 3 is going to go through our pipeline normally. And instruction 3 is going to need to read our 9. And you might say, wait a minute, this is a dependency here. Don't we need to worry about forwarding? Yes, we do, but let's look at this. We write the value at the end of cycle 4. With all the delay we had from handling our jump, we end up only reading it during cycle 5. There's no need for forwarding. It's fine, but we do have to use this value in our push instruction, and that is going to require some forwarding. So questions on what I have so far? Yes?
We don't need the value, we don't need to forward the value of, instruction 4 to instruction 5.
Good question, we don't need to forward the value of instruction 4 to instruction 5. What value?
I guess just like the PC value that we're jumping to.
The PC value that we're jumping to. So this call is an unconditional jump. We don't need to do any prediction for it. So it's true that we're going to be sending the PC to go through from fetch to fetch, just like we did from subtract to call, right? We just normally do that. As far as our PC increment, we can use the same process to handle this call. Now, if the call was, it was more complicated to compute where bar was, then maybe we'd have to do something else, but fortunately it's not. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so there's one piece of forwarding I haven't written on here that's rather important. So I'm telling you what that is. Yes, the stack pointer. So the call instruction, it's going to compute a new stack pointer value, and the push instruction needs to read that new stack pointer value, better not read the old one. So we need to also forward RSP. An RSP in call is computed in this execute stage because it's going to subtract from the stack pointer. We need to get that subtracted value into the push for its subtraction, and also its, and if store does afterwards. Okay, so questions? This timeline here. Yes?
So like if we squash things because the pitch jump is not taken, how does the PC know that
So the question is how are we going to know How do we know to fetch the subtract and not whatever 2D would be? So we're going to need to have some mux in front of the program, mux controlling the program counter somehow. So we're going to add an extra mux to do that. And we'll talk about this next time, but the preview is the textbook's design has this mux that's after the pre-C register, but which is one way of doing it. But we're going to have some sort of mux to make sure that that corrected PC is used instead of the normal value. Other questions? Okay, so let's say we're doing this not with fetch, decode, execute, memory write back, but with a 6-stage pipeline. What changes? Right, can someone tell me one thing that's going to change? Is it going to take one additional cycle? Yeah. So, Adam. So the earliest we can get the correct flag values is in what would naturally be jump's execute to. And let's assume, to keep things simpler, that jump figures out what to do in execute to. Doesn't need an extra cycle to do that. And so it only needs one cycle to compute the right PC. In that case, this is the earliest we could fetch the right thing. And in the meanwhile, we would fetch 3, not 2, extra instructions that we would have to squash. Also, the other difference we have is when we do out this logic, we find out, okay, this call here, since we need to forward RSP's value, well, that value isn't available to execute to. So in order to read it in time, we need to have one cycle stalling. So questions?
So like in this case, we're squashing 3 instructions if the initial is not entered. But like during the third instruction, are we not entering like the first stage and then there's going to be confusion with this?
So the question is, wouldn't we have trouble squashing during execute one stage? So if we go back to our chart of when things change in instructions, if we split up the execute stage, probably when condition codes change is only execute 2. So probably we don't have any extra work to do. Now, we could still handle if that wasn't the case, we just have to, in addition to changing the pipeline registers, we'd have to have like a backup copy of the old condition codes and restore them, which is something some real processors would do. You'd have like a backup copy of changed values and restore them back later. Yes? Question, why do we have to wait to NF execute 2 to, for call going to bar? So this is, this here, this is RSP being forwarded. And we haven't computed RSP until after we've done the subtraction. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Question, are 2B, 2C, and 2D represented 3, 4, 5, but mispredicted? Yes. So there are instructions starting at the label foo that we would run if we were actually going to foo. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. So we know sort of how our pipeline's sort of timeline's supposed to look. We're going to talk about actually implementing this. And we need to do some stuff to our pipeline registers in RPC, and what does that look like? So for our pipeline registers, we need to, in some cases, we want to do this sort of stalling logic where rather than taking, in this case we're going from fetch to decode, rather than taking new values to decode from the fetch stage, which rather from the instruction memory, we want to try again with the current values. So what we can implement this is we can have a mux which feeds back the current values sometimes, otherwise it uses the new values. So this is how we can implement that part of, you know, keeping an instruction in the code. So another thing we sometimes want to do is we want to send nothing instead of what would normally be sent. So we're thinking of like our, you know, case of our conditional jump, sometimes we wanted to ignore the instruction that was there and just send a no operation. Even if we're thinking of like keeping an instruction in the code, we don't want to send anything to execute. So to handle that, we'll have some logic in front of our pipeline register where sometimes we send a value that does nothing when we want to have the next stage not do anything next cycle, and sometimes we'll send the normal value. And we'll call this sending a bubble because we remember when we talked initially about stalling, that we have to fill those pipeline stages with something, like they're filled with like air, we would say. We call that a pipeline bubble. This is how we send a bubble. So we could implement these muxes on every single pipeline register, and that's a way we could do this. It turns out we're going to have a little help in HCLRS, so you don't have to do this. In HCLRS, these muxes are built in to every register bank. So you don't have to implement them again. You can use the HTRLS versions. You could also implement them yourself, but I don't recommend it. And the control signals for these are named after the outputs. So there's a signal called stall. In this case, the output is B, so stall B, which is going to implement this mux here. We'll feed back the old values. We'll keep the old values for the registers. You can also think of this as a write disable signal. There's a bubble signal, which uses the default values for all the registers. So we don't actually, so HCLRS doesn't know what a no-op value is, but it knows what the defaults are. And if we think of starting our processor, like during the first stage, we don't want to write anything, for example. So we're going to have values that don't do anything in the write-back stage. And we don't want to do anything with memory. So we're going to have values that don't do anything in the memory stage. So the assumption is all your pipeline registers' default values are going to be doing nothing. So that's what you're going to want for this. And you can think of this as a reset signal. So this bubble signal, we'll set it to the default values. And both of these say to replace the current thing we're writing. So we're trying to write some value. If we stall a set, that write's going to be ignored, and instead we're going to write the current output. If we're trying to write a value and bubble a set, that write's going to be ignored, and instead we're going to write the default values. So questions on these signals? Okay, so let's review how these work before we talk about using them in our pipeline. So here I have a timeline. And let's start with our first example. So during time zero, A value, which is the input to our register. So remember, we have our register value. We have an input, which is A underscore value. And we have an output, which is capital B underscore value. And A underscore value is is one during time zero. So, and stall and bubble are both set to zero, which is false. So we're not doing anything special. So our first part is what happens in normal operation of our register. And what we're doing is we have 01 sitting on the input. And currently the register is storing OXFF. And when we have our rising edge of the clock, what we're going to do is we're going to copy this 01 to the output. So our first time here, that's 0. So when you complete the table, remember that the way these stall and bubble signals work is they affect what we're writing now. They don't affect, we don't change the value that's currently being output, we change what the next value is. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's start with time two. Who can tell me what should we have at time two? So what would the normal value? So if we didn't have stall or bubble, what would the value be at time two? Anyone? Yeah.
0.02.
So normally, we take the value we read in at time one, and that would be the output during time two. So that would be the normal operation. But we have a stall signal sent at the same time, so that's going to modify how that write works. So what are we going to get instead? Yeah. 0.01. We're going to keep the old value. Okay, so what we're going to have, so that's time two. We have 0.01 as our output. Time three, tell me what should we have there? Anyone? Yes. 0.03. So during time three, we only look at the current time signals, and we're just doing a normal write of the register. So in fact, we got 0.03, just the value that was being written. Just like our starting case, we're just sending the input value to the output in the next time. So. Okay, how about during time four? Who can tell me what the value should be? No one.
The FF.
FF? And why is that? The bubble is set to one, and that's going to modify the write operation we're doing. So instead of writing four here, we're not going to write four. We're going to write the default value, which is set up here. Okay, and time 5. Oh, I guess I'll time this. So time 5, well, we look at the operation here. We have no stall, no bubble. So we're going to get OX05. Time 6, we have no stall, no bubble. We're going to get OX06. We're just passing through our input normally. During time 6, we're modifying that write. So we'd like to write 7, but the stall signal is set. So instead, we're going to store the same value. So we're going to keep 6. During time 7, we'd like to write 8, but the stall signal is set, so we're not going to do that. Instead, we're going to keep the old value, which is 6. It doesn't matter that we tried to write 7 before. We're just going to keep the old value, whatever it was. So questions? How our stall and bubble muxes work before we move on to actually using them. Right, I have the clean version of this. Okay, so we know how these muxes work. Let's actually apply this to manipulating instructions. So let's say during time 1, we have instructions A through E in our pipeline. And during time 2, what I want to happen is I want to be fetching instruction E again. That we need to keep it back. I want to have gotten rid of instruction D. So it's not in the pipeline anymore. And I'm running nothing in the code. I want to have kept instruction C in execute. And I want to have let instruction B advance normally from memory to write back. And my question is, how do I set the stall and bubble signals during time 1 for my pipeline registers, these 4 registers here? We'll worry about the fetch register separately because we might handle that specially, given like conditional jumps needed to do something really weird. Just how do I set the stall and bubble signals for fetch to decode during time 1, for decode to execute to make this happen? That I want this particular set of instructions to advance or stay in place following this pattern. If you'd like some more time, be welcome. Okay, so let's start with our fetch to decode registers. So this would be the stall and bubble D signals. So who thinks we want to set stall for that? Thinks we want to set normal, not neither stall nor bubble. And who thinks we want bubble? Okay, so we have good consensus on bubble, okay. So how about for decode to execute, which would be stall E and bubble E? Who thinks we want to set stall? Thinks we want to set normal? Who thinks we want to set bubble? Okay, so we have a split between stall and normal. So if we think of this as the register, like it goes from decode to execute, the normal operation would be to send the D here. We have the D instruction go to there. That's not what ends up happening, so we can't be doing normal. If we did stall, it's going to keep what's previously outputting. So outputting C here we're still going to, because that's what ended up there. So if you want to keep doing that, you want to set this to stall. So stall is the answer we went there. If we do the normal thing, instead instruction D will advance from decode to execute, which is not what we're trying to do in this case. So in this case, we're actually eliminating instruction D. It goes away. Okay, how about from execute to memory? Who thinks we want to stall? Thinks we want to do the normal operation, neither stall nor bubble. Thinks we want to bubble. Okay, so we have one, so this is bubble. And that's going to be the bubble M signal. And how about from memory to write back? Who thinks we want to stall? Thinks we want to do the normal thing. Thinks we want to bubble. Okay, so most people want to do the normal thing, which is, in fact, the answers I get. So questions on how I figure that out? So this is sort of how you can figure out how should these signals be set. He thinks remembers we're thinking about setting them during time one, and we just think of what we want there in the next cycle. Like to think about it. How do I make that happen? So let's do second version of it. We'll not worry about fetch to fetch. So how about, let's do fetch to decode. Who thinks we should just stall? Normal? Bubble? Okay, so we have consensus on normal. How about decode to execute? Who thinks we should stall? Normal? Bubble? So we have pretty good consensus on stall. Execute to memory. Who thinks we should stall? Normal? Bubble? We have that. And memory to write back will be normal. So I think we are pretty comfortable with this. So this sort of shows us our general strategy. If we know what we want to happen in the next stage, we know how to make it happen. So let's think about applying this to handling or some situations we've seen before. So if we're doing stalling, and this is a point I'm going to emphasize because it's a big point of confusion, our textbook is named the stall and bubble signals. I got the names from the textbook. They're named not very good. Because when we're stalling an instruction, so in this case, the subtract instruction is being stalled. The way we're implementing that involves both the stall and bubble signals. Why does it involve both? Well, because during cycle three here, the execute stage needs something to do. If we do nothing, what we'd end up with is we'd end up having another copy of the subtract instruction going into the execute stage. That if we think of our timeline, we'd have, I guess, fetch, decode, execute. We'd have subtract in our decode stage, and we want to end up with nothing in the execute stage and the subtract stay, right? So we need to do a bubble operation, and we also need to do a stall operation going into the decode stage to implement this. So we're going to end up with, we're going to have to do some stalls. In this case, we're going to do a stall for the decode stage, and we're going to have to do something about the PC too, which could be a stall or something in our mux. And we're going to have to do a bubble. So implementing stalling an instruction involves both the stall and bubble signals. We need the stall to keep the instruction back. We also need to keep it from going forward, because if we don't do anything, it's going to go forward. And then we'd have two subtract instructions, and that's probably not going to work out very well. So we stop that with the bubble, replacing it with a nup. So questions on this logic for stalls and why we need to have a bubble in the case where we're doing a stall in addition to the stall signals being sent. Okay. So we also, before we start our topic today, talked about squashing instructions. So that's going to be done with our bubble signal. So if we think of what happens here, is that I'm going to set bubble E and bubble D to replace our instructions that would normally move on normally in our pipeline with nums. That's going to be our implementation of the squashing for condition jump, and we're going to do this in the execute stage of the jump, because that's when we're deciding not to write the normal values from our mispredicted XOR, but to write a num. So questions? This timeline will go through some other versions of this example. So I guess maybe a clearer way of thinking about it is here's our timeline where we have some predicted instructions. We want to fetch the correct ones. We're going to use set bubble signals in order to make that happen. So if we think of what's happening here, I want to fetch a different instruction that we didn't mispredict, and I want to take the ones we predicted wrong and replace them with no ones. So I'm going to use the bubble signal to do that, and in this case, for decode and execute. So bubble D and bubble E. Okay. So questions about, so this is sort of just the same timeline we had for our conditional jump with misprediction. Now I'm just annotating what it looks like. So how do we implement this in HCRS? So now I want to set bubble D and bubble E. When do I set them? Well, I'm going to have to set these based on the outcome of the jump. So I'm going to figure out in the execute stage of the jump, am I running a jump that was mispredicted? Where I decided, thought it was taken, that was my guess, it wasn't. And if so, I'm going to set bubble D and bubble E. So questions on logic. So note that I'm doing this in the execute stage of the jump, right? I have to do this before we fill the pipeline registers for the next stage. So I have to prepare the instructions so they have nums. So this is my implementation of that. I'm saying, I'm looking here, I'm saying, okay, you know, I'm looking in this part here, doing the logic to set bubble D and bubble E. Questions are squashing. Okay, so we also had mentioned earlier that we had to stall for return, and we're still stalling for return. So how is that going to look? So most likely, we're going to have a bunch of cycles where we don't know what to fetch, but we don't want the rest of the pipeline to do anything. So I just want to send nops down the pipeline while we can't figure out what to fetch for return. And if we draw this sort of as our diagram here, we can think of this as I need to put a no-op into code. I don't need to do anything else. I could like set the bubble signal from decode to execute during state cycle 4 here, but if I do nothing, it still works. I'm sending nothing down the pipeline. So a way we can implement this stalling is we just need to make sure we don't have the code do anything while we're waiting for something to do. And how can I tell that I don't have anything to do? Well, I can look at this return. If there's a return into code, you know, I know there's nothing to do in the next cycle into code. If there's a return in execute, I know there's nothing to do because it's not gone to memory yet. So I'm going to look at, is there a return going through the pipeline? If so, the code doesn't have anything to do. So I can implement this something like this. I can say, is there a return later in the pipeline that hasn't made it past memory yet? If so, we don't know what we're doing, so let's make sure the code doesn't do anything. And that's how I handle the pipeline register part of our return stall. So there's a part we didn't mention, which we'll talk about as our first topic next time, which is, well, I talked about setting our pipeline registers, I didn't talk about setting the program counter. So we need to have some logic for the program counter. So we're going to have some muxes to handle our program counter cases where we need to like get a predicted value that was, get a mispredicted value to fetch the right instruction, or get the target of a return to actually jump to. So we'll talk about that next time. See you Thursday.